Susan Spencer, CBS News in Montreal.
The epidemic of HIV infection is out of control. It's out of control in the United States. It's out of control in the world.
The HIV/AIDS situation in the decade of the 1990s will be more serious and perhaps much more serious than that which we have experienced during the 1980s.
Like every one of you, I don't want to die. At least not now.
Judy Muller and I look at the numbers and the issues of the 5th International AIDS Conference in Montreal.
I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.
We can expect a police repression of a very severe sort in China for quite a considerable time after this.
On Newsmark this week, what next for China?
I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News.
It changes all the time. It changes its velocity. It changes its location. It writhes like a sidewinder.
It's been called the river in the sea, the weather in the ocean. Author William McLeish talks about the Gulf Stream on Newsmark. Our Newsmark broadcast begins in a moment.
Hi, this is Robert Conrad. When it comes to enjoying America's great outdoors, I'll take the National Forest every time. They stretch all the way from Chugach National Forest in Alaska to the Caribbean National Forest in Puerto Rico. There are 156 in all, ones within a day's drive of wherever you live. They add up to 191 million acres of scenic forests and grasslands, carefully managed to give us many benefits forever. What's great about the National Forest is that they're there for everyone. If you're an outdoors person, there's all kinds of things you can do, from whitewater rafting to mountain climbing. But if you would rather sit back and enjoy the scene from your car or go hiking along a nature trail, the forests are for you, too. To find out more about America's great outdoors, write Forest for Us, Box 2000, Washington, D.C., 20013, and get ready to enjoy.
A message from the Forest Service, USDA.
Newsmark, I'm Susan Spencer, CBS News in Montreal. The numbers were staggering. Over 11,000 researchers, 900 journalists, 6,000 presentations, all in one place for 1 week, the 5th International Conference on AIDS. The numbers coming out of this conference are staggering, too. Dr. Jonathan Mann of the World Health Organization.
During the 1990s, approximately nine times more cases of AIDS may occur than occurred during the 1980s. About half of the people developing AIDS during the 1990s were infected with HIV during the 1980s. Again, over one-third of the AIDS cases resulting from new infections in the 1990s were considered preventable through global and national efforts.
Dr. Mann explains these figures another way.
The number of people with AIDS is rising sharply. From about 70,000 from 1980 through 1985 to about 300,000 people developing AIDS from 1986 through 1988, to an estimated 700,000 people developing AIDS in the three-year period 1989 to 1991. Thus, the cumulative total of AIDS is expected to double from today to the end of 1991 to over 1.1 million.
The World Health Organization also estimates that there are now between 5 and 10 million people infected with HIV around the world, with perhaps only 10% even knowing it. Dr. William Hendy of the American Medical Association.
The epidemic of HIV infection is out of control. It's out of control in the United States. It's out of control in the world.
The number of people who unknowingly carry the AIDS virus is even more distressing if you consider it in light of new medical advances. Clinical trials using AZT have shown that early use in people positive for the virus appears to delay the onset of the symptoms of AIDS. But if interventional care is most effective when implemented early, this will require the periodic testing and evaluation of people infected but who have no symptoms. Dr. Hendy.
Think what this means. Immediately, the patient population expands dramatically from persons experiencing clinical symptoms of HIV disease to the entire population of persons infected with the virus. Today, it is the 1.5 million persons in the United States and the 5 to 10 million persons worldwide who are HIV positive, who now become the patient population. If only we could identify them.
All of this raises the question of money.
Who is going to provide the testing, the monitoring, the evaluation, and the interventional health care that all these people will need? And where is it going to be provided? And who is going to provide all the counseling needed by these patients and their loved ones? And who is going to pay for all this?
It's clear that to stop the transmission of AIDS, much more than medical technology is needed. And there was much focus at the Fifth International Conference on educational campaigns aimed at stopping high-risk behavior.
Yes, there is. We'll recall the conference did nothing at all.
There were protesters and activists shouting their demands and concerns. Some scientists felt that there was too much shouting, too much talk about social issues, not enough scientific discussion. Still, there was a sense of progress on the medical front. Polio vaccine pioneer Jonas Salk reported some interesting results on a post-exposure AIDS vaccine. Salk injected it into three chimpanzees, two with the AIDS virus, the third without. The chimps with the infection lost all signs of the virus for over a year, while the uninfected chimp, though, exposed to the same vaccine, showed signs of infection over the same period of time. So what does this suggest? Dr. Jonas Salk.
It suggests that it may be possible to vaccinate against infection and also to perhaps, if not against infection, against the development of disease, because the infection could then be of shorter duration.
Leading researcher Dr. Danny Bolognesi of Duke University says the results are inconclusive.
The number of animals are low. The degree of protection is incomplete. It doesn't happen in all of the animals. But as I tried to tell you this morning, they are beginnings of progress that we did not have a year ago.
Further confusing the picture is the fact that Dr. Salk's experimental vaccine hasn't had success in humans yet. Dr. Bolognesi.
Why is there no evidence in man that this vaccine is clearing the infection, whereas there is evidence in the chimpanzee? I don't know. I wonder that myself. And again, I would at this point talk about this as a preliminary result that needs to be solidified.
But it's early days yet. Also on the hopeful signs front, the FDA approval expected soon for aerosol pentamidine, a drug proven effective in fighting AIDS-related pneumonia. But even that good news raised questions from AIDS activists as to who could get it and how it would be paid for. All the scientific information at this conference ran into such issues and broader questions. How does basic science relate to society, to ethics and law? Ethicist David Roy.
It seems that the message is, as the virus has become endemic in the human population, the problems associated with HIV disease and with AIDS have metastasized, if I could use that language, into all of the organs of society. And so it shouldn't be surprising if in coming conferences we find increasing emphasis and spotlight upon the social, psychological, familial, international, relational, ethical, legal aspects of this disease.
The clear message from the Fifth International AIDS Conference, a sobering one. The number of HIV-infected people in the world is growing and growing fast. And while there's much hope in basic science, there is still an enormous struggle ahead. I'm Susan Spencer, CBS News, Montreal. Newsmark continues with a look at the ethics of AIDS in just a moment.
Club 8000 introduces car insurance that won't drive you to the poorhouse.
I'm really impressed with Club 8000. I was very happy to find their companies comply with Prop 103. So good drivers get an extra discount this November. For a change, that really makes me feel good about my car insurance.
When my husband and I bought a new house in a new neighborhood, more than our mortgage payment went up, our car insurance went up too. So we call Club 8000. Now we don't have to sell the car to afford the house.
To find out just how affordable car insurance can be, call Club 8000, toll free 1-800-822-8000. Call Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Once more, the toll-free number is 1-800-822-8000 for car insurance that won't drive you to the poorhouse.
Newsmark, I'm Judy Muller, CBS News. How should people with AIDS be treated? That's a question the Fifth International AIDS Conference grappled with this past week in Montreal. The answer? With respect, dignity, and compassion. But there is prejudice towards people who test seropositive for HIV antibodies. So says Ron Kelly, a student who himself has tested seropositive.
The first thing we have to do is admit that discrimination really takes place. Discrimination is not in the minds of people with AIDS. It's real.
Very real for Ron Kelly.
I've lost a lot of my self-respect, which I'm starting to get back. I've lost a lot of my friends, and I've experienced firsthand what it's like to have people treat me like dirt because I carry the virus, which is believed to cause AIDS.
There is the sense of shame that many people feel with AIDS, a sense of shame Ron Kelly wants to fight.
There is no shame in having the AIDS virus. There is no shame in having HIV infection. And that's a message that as doctors, as scientists, as educators, as teachers, we must take not only to the people of Canada, but the people across the world.
Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, president of Zambia, also wants to fight that sense of shame and stigma attached to AIDS.
We have to remove the social stigma from AIDS. We have to convince with kindness and generosity of heart both the sufferer and the community that AIDS is a disease.
In 1986, Kaunda's son died of AIDS.
It is such a tragic event in our family that the best way we would wish to mourn this boy is by fighting AIDS.
It is a fight, says Kaunda, that we need to win.
If you, our scientists, fail to find a cure in a good time, the AIDS epidemic will develop upon our population into a soft nuclear bomb on human life. Silent, no explosion, but just as devastating on the destruction of the human body.
But science and medicine face their own ethical difficulties. Problems such as double-blind clinical tests, where neither doctor nor patient knows who is receiving medication or a placebo.
Like every one of you, I don't want to die. At least, not now.
Claude LeBlanc is a man in his 30s with AIDS.
And I don't want to suffer either unusefully.
Like many others with AIDS, LeBlanc joined a clinical trial in the hope new drugs could prolong his life. He was made to feel like a human guinea pig and not a patient.
What really upset me was that every time I went to see the physician, he never took notes, pretending he had a good memory and said he will write them in my file later. And he never examined me.
Quality of life is an important issue for people with AIDS, especially for the children. Barbara Chamness already has 3 grown children, but now she's a foster mother for 3 more children, 2 with AIDS. We spoke with her about how she will cope with the grief that loving these children is sure to bring.
Somehow we've got to learn to care for our human family. One of the things about this conference, I spent my facelift money to go to Stockholm last year because I wanted to hear of a medical cure. But one of the things I've discovered is that our advances in science and medicine have outstripped our advances in our ability to really compassionately care for each other. And that's what I want us to do with these children.
What is John's life expectancy at this point, and how is his health?
If we believe statistics, John has a 90% chance of being dead before the age of 3, 95% chance before the age of 5. He has had pneumocystis twice. He has large swollen lymph nodes, but now he's doing well. And, of course, we think that we're going to beat the odds. I'm hoping for a cure.
There is a hopeful aspect to controlling the AIDS epidemic besides medical research, behavioral change. June Osborne, Dean of the University of Michigan, explains.
In a world full of fearsome things, HIV should not be high on the list, for risk behavior can be avoided. That is the one bit of truly good news in this awful epidemic, and we should pause to celebrate it.
The question of how to treat people with AIDS on a medical basis and a personal basis is a complicated one. But, as Osborne says, if we collect what we have learned and find out how to mobilize it, the net gain for our human communities will reach far beyond the conquest of AIDS. I'm Judy Muller, CBS News, Montreal. Newsmark will continue in a moment.
Heard much about AIDS lately?
Ask me if I've heard about anything else.
Really? So your friends talk about AIDS?
No, no one does.
But you said you haven't heard anything else.
That's because it's in the paper and on TV all the time.
If AIDS is so important, why don't your friends talk about it?
I guess they're embarrassed.
Are you embarrassed?
AIDS isn't exactly what you'd call party conversation.
No, it's no party. But how are we ever going to prevent AIDS if we can't even talk about it?
But how do you talk to someone about AIDS?
Just like this.
Talk about AIDS, because talking will help you understand. If you'd like more information, call your local AIDS hotline or call 1-800-342-AIDS. This has been a message from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Newsmark. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News. China in recent days has gone from mass protest to mass killing to mass repression. The world's most populous nation, a nuclear power, is in the throes of a showdown between people power and Communist Party power. For some insight, we talked to Dr. Thomas Robinson, Director of China Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Robinson, at week's end, Deng Xiaoping, Li Peng, appeared in public for the first time in days and adopted a very hard line. Deng Xiaoping grieving for the security forces and soldiers who died in the unrest of the previous weekend, but saying not a word about the pro-democracy campaigners who were killed by the hundreds. What do you make of the reemergence of the leadership, the senior people, after spending so long cooped up wherever they were?
This is obviously a case of the party trying to reassert itself by pretending that it has control of the situation. In fact, the situation is still in control of the army. Perhaps it is true that Deng Xiaoping has personal control over some elements in the army, but not fully. So I don't think that this is a signal that the situation will get back to normal, cannot get back to normal for some years.
China is a very complex society. It's difficult for Westerners, I'm sure, to understand it fully. The Communist Party apparatus there is the one unifying factor, has been, since the Great Revolution. But it has gone through periods of upheaval and turmoil, this being perhaps one of the greatest, if not the greatest. What do you think is responsible for the timing? Why now?
That's a very complex question. The factors include the importation through the media and through students and other manners of Western ways of thinking, including democracy, the whole Deng liberalization period in the economic sense for the last 10 years, the feeling that the Soviet Union had gotten ahead of China in the political liberalization sense, and the fact that the students themselves evaluated the party itself as corrupt, inefficient, and not capable of serving the whole modernization drive.
It may sound like a radical question, but is China ready for democracy?
Every country is ready for democracy. The United States was ready for democracy 200 years ago when we were an underdeveloped country. It is a matter of tolerance, a feeling that if people work together, then they will be better off. But the problem is the Chinese Communist Party is not ready for democracy. By definition, a Communist Party, and particularly the Chinese Party, is anti-democratic. It is totalitarian. It does not want to share power in any manner with anybody else. And until that changes, there will be no democracy in China.
But some of the party leaders apparently have begun to see the light. Zhao Ziyang, among others, apparently have lost out, though, in the power struggle.
And that's the very point. Those that have attempted to liberalize are those that have lost, and their student supporters are now dead. And we can expect a police repression of a very severe sort in China for quite a considerable time after this.
Do they have enough police, enough jails, enough courts to really accomplish that, if this, in fact, is a widespread popular movement?
It's a widespread popular movement, but a police state, which is what China is now, once again, can always find enough people, guns, courts, prisons, and so forth, to put large numbers of people in jail.
And it appears from their statements of the last few days that the Chinese government, the hardliners, are prepared to suffer the approbation of the rest of the world during this period.
Any communist party will do that in order to preserve itself in power. The Chinese Communist Party is no different in this regard from all the others.
But at what cost to the Chinese economy?
Oh, a great deal. But the point is that they are prepared to take any short-term or medium-term decreases in economic activity in order to preserve their own political power. Politics comes first in China, according to the Chinese Communist Party.
Now, you speak in terms of years for this period of upheaval and repression.
Well, it could well be. The Cultural Revolution was 10 years long, the Great Leap Forward, and its unfortunate aftermath, the anti-rightist campaign of the Hundred Flowers, all were also years long. The repressions of the early 50s were years long. China's a big country. It takes a long time to repress a lot of people and to get over this kind of thing. It will be years.
Now, the position of the Bush administration is that it wants to maintain friendly ties with the Chinese if they would only see the light. How can the United States deal with China during this period of crisis?
Well, of course, it's a very difficult question. I think we ought to go a little further than the Bush administration has gone. I think we ought to have pulled our ambassador out of China, not broken diplomatic relations completely. But in fact, we will be doing a number of things, both in the business, technology transfer, training of students areas, that will lead to showing the Chinese Communist Party that we are very unhappy and dissatisfied with this event.
If this sidetracks relations with the United States, what does it do to the Sino-Soviet relationship?
Well, does not, I think, help Sino-Soviet relations, so long as Gorbachev and his supporters in the political liberalization sense are in power in the Soviet Union. The Sino-Soviet summit did improve Sino-Soviet relations a great deal. I think that the terms of the improvement will be carried out by both sides, whoever happens to be in power in the two countries.
Another important player is Japan. Where does Japan stand?
Well, Japan stands with the United States, fortunately, and I think will continue to do that. It follows the American lead. It has criticized the Chinese, more muted perhaps than that of the United American criticism. But, in fact, they will stand with us. They are a democratic country.
Dr. Thomas Robinson, Director of China Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. We thank you, sir. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News. Our Newsmark broadcast continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm here today with a reminder about the one and only American Tool Exchange, home of the world-famous $1 tool bins and the lowest prices this side of the Mississippi. Before you weekend handymen and professional contractors jump in your trucks looking for the nearest one and only American Tool Exchange, remember, the reason we call it the one and only American Tool Exchange is that there is only one American Tool Exchange in North Hollywood on the corner of Satakoi South and Whitsitt. Now, if that sounds like a long distance from where you are, say in Barstow or Salinas, don't fret. I got an idea. Pack up your truck and take a road trip to the one and only American Tool Exchange. With the money you save on famous name tools like Makita, Vice Grip, and Bosch, you can bring the whole family along to see some of the major attractions down here. The American Tool Exchange will even treat you to a cup of coffee for the ride home. But remember, there is only one American Tool Exchange at Satakoi South and Whitsitt in North Hollywood. If you're traveling from out of state or a foreign country, call ahead. We'll send you a map. Have a pleasant trip.
Newsmark. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. Francis Bacon once wrote that nature to be commanded must be obeyed. To obey nature, you must first explore and understand it. William MacLeish, in his book The Gulf Stream, has explored one of nature's greatest forces, the Gulf Stream. We talk with him about what he found.
The Gulf Stream is, in reality, is the western part, the western arc, if you will, of a great swirl in the North Atlantic that goes from the coast of North America, coast of the United States and Canada, across towards Europe and bends down along the western bulge of Africa and back to the Caribbean up to Florida again.
Explain the word gyre to me.
Gyre is that swirl. As in gyroscope, it is a great ellipse in the ocean of currents that are loosely associated, and it moves in a clockwise direction.
If it is an engine, Mr. MacLeish, what makes the engine go? What's the fuel?
The sun. The sun pours its heat towards into the earth, and as the heat is received more in the equatorial regions than in the polar regions, and this differential, if you will, sets up something very much like the mechanism we have in our furnaces. In order to react to this inequality of what we call insulation, of received heat from the sun, there is movement of heat from the equatorial regions toward the poles, and then a cold flow, in order to have a return flow, a cold flow of both air and water coming back towards the equator.
Does a given drop of water make the whole trip?
It's very hard to follow a given drop of water. It may be a given drop of water might be caught in an eddy. It might be caught in a particular part of the circulation system and not make the whole thing. But a sufficient number of particles of water make the circle to guarantee the presence of that gyre.
Is the stream of constant width, or does it change like a river might?
It changes all the time. It changes its velocity. It changes its location. It writhes like a sidewinder.
How does our weather, the weather, say, in North America and the weather in Europe, how is it affected by what happens in the stream?
Well, this is interesting. The stream has some effect on the weather along the east coast of the United States. As you know, most of the prevailing winds that come across the continent are moving from the west to the east, and the stream is east of the continent, therefore downwind. But the stream does have an effect on what we call bombs or winter hurricanes. It's the heat rising from its surface into the air sometimes interacts with other very cold masses of air to produce winter hurricanes. And one of those, you may remember back in 1978, dumped 4 feet on Boston, immobilized the whole thing for a week. Now, that is weather. The climate influence is downstream of the Gulf Stream, which and occurs, therefore, in Europe. The stream brings enormous quantities of warm water into the northern waters. And you will see, for example, off the Grand Banks, which is the downstream end of the Gulf Stream, according to oceanographers, sea smoke, fogs, a great deal of heat being released to the air. And, of course, that's picked up, that heat and moisture is picked up by winds coming off of Canada and carried to Europe, and where it creates a maritime climate in winter.
Another thing that I think most people have very little sense of is the depth of the ocean.
This is true, and this is something that I think many people do not understand, that there is a considerable depth to these oceans, and not only that, but there is a vertical circulation. In other words, we've been talking about the Gulf Stream on the surface carrying a lot of warm water. Well, that water, as it's brought north, begins to cool. It is cooled sufficiently after a while by polar winds so that it sinks. And when it sinks, it comes back down towards the equator along the bottom. And there it can reside for hundreds or thousands of years. And this movement along the bottom, slow or rapid, depending on what's going on down there, is of great importance to us in determining how much of our wastes, including things like carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, how much of our wastes the oceans can absorb and store for a while.
There seems to be a lot of interest right now about the Gulf Stream. Is it your book that has occasioned this, or are you part of renewed interest in the subject?
Well, I would like to think it's my book, but I think this occurred before its publication. The interest in the Gulf Stream is part and parcel of an interest in the oceans per se, and that is part and parcel of a renewed interest in the interplay between oceans and atmosphere occasioned by the rising apprehension over the greenhouse effect, the warming of the globe.
And is this related to the Gulf Stream?
Yes, it is. It's related because the Gulf Stream is, in effect, an engine, one of the prime engines of the ocean, in carrying heat from the tropics towards the poles, just as winds rise from the equator and go towards the poles carrying heat. This mechanism is one of the basic mechanisms that makes it possible for you and me to exist.
William McLeish, author and explorer of the Gulf Stream. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. Newsmark segments for this week were produced by Evelyn Lee, Jill Landis, and Richard Stapleton. Executive producer, Joanne Malley. Newsmark is a presentation of CBS News.
CBS News, this is Frank Settapani. The United States and China may be heading for a diplomatic Donnybrook over the status of China's leading pro-democracy dissident. Fang Lijie and his wife have been hiding in the U.S. embassy since troops moved through Tiananmen Square cutting down civilians. Now an order for his arrest is out. U.S. Ambassador James Lilly says he hopes the two governments can work out a deal.
I hope to God it can, because I don't think we want irritants in the Chinese-American relationship. But we Americans stand for certain things, and I don't think we're going to change. And I think the Chinese stand for certain things, and they're not going to change, and then you strike a deal.
The government continues to make mass arrests of its opponents and, as CBS News correspondent Bob Simon tells us, to publicize them.
It's remarkable. Other regimes which beat people up and then put them in kangaroo courts and make them sign false confessions try to conceal it and deny it. China, for the last few days, has been advertising it, literally advertising it, on the world's largest television network. It seems to demonstrate that, for the authorities, China's image in the international community is nowhere near the top of its priorities.
Bob Simon in Beijing. ABC News says it's deeply distressed the Chinese authorities intercepted a satellite feed of a man-in-the-street interview in Beijing, put the tape on television, and then used it to arrest the man for rumor-mongering. The Beijing man told ABC 20,000 people died in the crackdown on China's pro-democracy movement. Chinese officials say only 300 died, mostly soldiers attacked by ruffians. Soviet President Gorbachev begins a four-day visit to West Germany tomorrow. Jesse Schulman in Bonn reports that hopes are high, but expectations are low.
The Soviets are playing down the chance of a new Gorbachev surprise during his visit to West Germany. They say it's too soon to answer President Bush's latest arms proposals. The Berlin Wall remains a sore point in this country, but Soviet spokesman Gennady Gerasimov said it's not up to the Soviets to tear down the barriers that divide East and West Germany.
We now have two Germanys. They are two separate states. So it's actually, it's not our problem, this wall.
Gerasimov said the wall could come down when conditions that led to it had changed. He declined to say just when that might happen. Jesse Schulman for CBS News, Bonn.
The dollar made what's believed to be a record leap in Monday morning trading in Tokyo. It jumped more than 4 yen to 147.6 yen. Traders said the run-up was a delayed response to last Friday's report showing a sharp increase in U.S. wholesale prices, which would seem to rule out significantly lower U.S. interest rates anytime soon. High interest rates encourage foreigners to stick with dollar-denominated investments. In Garner, North Carolina, near Raleigh-Durham, three people died when the hot air balloon they were in struck wires attached to a television tower and plunged more than 1,000 feet to the ground. The fire burning in a 2.5 million gallon tank of methanol in Plaquemine, Louisiana, should burn itself out by daylight tomorrow. A lightning bolt sparked the fire. At 3 minutes after the hour, this is CBS News.
Say, Dad, can you help me decide which tires to get? They all look great.
Well, looks aren't everything. Pick the tires that sound best.
Sound best? How do I do that?
Just say Rhino Tough out loud.
Rhino Tough? Hey, what was that?
That's the Armstrong Rhino.
The Armstrong Rhino?
Sure, because only Armstrong tires are made Rhino Tough. So Armstrongs are the tires you can depend on for outstanding traction, stability, and durability.
Armstrong tires, huh?
Yeah. They're Rhino Tough.
It was the summer after high school, and my best friend Jerome and I went fishing every day at McCormick's Creek. One hot day in mid-July, we made a pact to be best friends for life. This summer, make good memories and lots of Country Time lemonade-flavored drink mix. Also in cans, not too tart, not too sweet. Tastes like good old-fashioned lemonade. And hey, Jerome, if you're listening, hi, buddy.
Country Time, these are the good old days.
Some Southern Baptists will boycott the church's national convention in Las Vegas this week because of that city's reputation as a sin city. Those who attend plan to take part in an aggressive conversion drive. The man who started the Moral Majority as a political action organization for the religious right says the group is disbanding. The Moral Majority failed to get abortion outlawed or silent prayer legalized in public schools, but the Reverend Jerry Falwell says it accomplished the mission it set out for itself a decade ago. 19-year-old Alexei Sultanov of the Soviet Union captured the 8th Van Cliburn International Piano Competition in Fort Worth, Texas. The event is named for the young American pianist who gained worldwide fame by winning the Tchaikovsky Competition in the Soviet Union in 1958. At the age of 17, Michael Chang accomplished what no other American was able to do for 34 years. He won the French Open Tennis Championship, upsetting Stefan Edberg in five sets. Frank Settapani, CBS News.